This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
We're going to start with a couple stories about Iran. The Islamic Republic has been making headlines lately with attacks on ships that threaten oil shipping routes, other provocative acts. And this is challenging other nations to take action in response. We're seeing some definite fault lines in the way that they're responding. We're going to talk in a moment about the dividing line between the United States and Europe that is showing itself. Germany in particular saying it has no interest in helping the U.S. in its measures to patrol and secure the Straits of Hormuz, the Strait of Hormuz. First, though, we're going to look at Israel. This week, it actually made an airstrike on a missile depot. This is the second time it's done so in the past month. For this story, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, this is significant. We talk a lot about Israeli strikes on Iranian targets, or at least Iranian proxies in Lebanon and Syria, and even in the Gaza Strip. But these are two strikes that took place in Iraq. And this is the first time that Israel has struck Iraq in 30 years, almost three decades. And so this is a serious change and a serious decision that Israel has made. No doubt Israel made this with the full knowledge of the United States, striking these Iranian, let's say Iranian proxies inside the Iraqi government military bases. These were just north of Baghdad, 50 kilometers north of Baghdad and 105, I think, kilometers north of Baghdad. So this is a huge distance. When you look at a map, you see this is, you know, Baghdad's quite close to the Iranian border itself. And so Israeli jets flew over there twice in the past month and took out these missile depots. And the second one of those, 40 people were killed, Iranians and also Iraqis were killed in this. And yet you won't see much reporting of it. It's pretty hushed in the press. Israel doesn't talk about it in the sense that they're not acknowledging it or owning up to it. But the fact that these bases were known holding stations for Iranian weapons, Iranian missiles, Iranian ballistic missiles, missiles that are meant to that Israel knows are meant to are going to be used or attempted to be used against them. It shows that Israel was the one that was acted here. The United States obviously would like to act against Iranian interests in Iraq, but they wouldn't dare just yet in this way. And so Israel, fearing for its own safety, decided to take out these arms depots.
If you could put it in context for us, Brent, the significance of the fact that it was Iraq where these missile depots were located and how we know that Iran is the one implicated.
Well, it's significant because Israel does this type of thing in Syria all the time. They've done over 1,000 strikes or nearly 1,000 strikes in Syria in the past 8 years against exactly this type of thing. Apart from the missiles that were at these bases were greater than the missiles that they attack or the arms convoys and depots in Syria that they attack, because Israel can't afford to have these type of missiles that close to the border. It's been widely reported, Reuters and others, in the past year that Iran is pushing its missiles onto Shiite proxies. These are organizations that have closer ties to Iran than they do to the Iraqi parliament. Both of these bases were owned and operated by the Badr organization. This is an organization that's fought against American forces in the Iraq going back decades. They have known ties to Iran. They were one of the Shiite militias that were used to fight the Islamic State. They are now part of the Iraqi government, even holding the health ministry and the previous government. And these fighters, there's 50,000 of them in the Badr organization, are meant to come underneath the governance of the Iraqi government. And yet they haven't yet. they're taking on arms shipments. The Qassem Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force from Iran, he is seen often with this group. And so we know that it was definitely them that was holding these weapons. Now, what's different, though, is Israel has decided that Iraq is fair game. Mm. Iraqi territory is fair game for Israeli strikes. It's one thing, and I just would like to quote, actually, Jonathan Speier. He wrote about this, and he wrote about this this week in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. He said this: "Yet hitting the Iranians in lawless Syria is one thing, in line with the general contours of Israeli activity and defense strategy in recent years. An Israeli attack in Iraq is another, constituting a significant expansion of the military theater." And then he goes on to talk about, hey, this Middle East is already crazy, and it just got crazier now that Iraq is a legitimate target for Israel. And of course it is. Israel is saying that, well, this is great. We have pushed them out of Syria, or at least these weapons are not getting into Syria. Now we have to attack them in Iraq even further away. But what Jonathan Speier goes on to say is, hold on a second. It shows that Iraq is a basically a vassal of Iran right now. Mm-hmm. It holds, well, inside Iraq's territory, massive forces that belong and answer to Iran. This is something we've been saying is happening.
Yep.
And yet the Israeli military is basically confirming our prophecy from 30 years ago that Iran is going to take over Iraq, to the point that Israel is now fighting against Iran inside Iraq.
Yeah, just remind our listeners about that prophecy.
Our editor-in-chief has talked about the King of the South, and this is being Iran, radical Islam led by Iran. And this is a prophecy found in the book of Daniel, chapter 11 and verse 40, in the following verses. It talks about the initial war that starts off, basically the Great Tribulation. It is between this King of the South and the King of the North, or a European force. And he said that for this King of the South to be so dominant, it needs to control Iraq. And so he has said that Iran and Iraq are going to come together, and that Iran is going to be the king, and Iraq will basically be a vassal to Iran. And that's what we've seen take place, especially over the past, let's say, about 2 or 3 years, in the demise of the Islamic State and the waning of American power in the Middle East. Right now, this is a fact. And as I said, I mean, Israel striking, this strike basically confirms that this prophecy is moving forward.
Tell us a little bit more about these missiles, why they posed a threat to Israel. And then I'd like to transition into just a little more about how much America's support for Israel is maybe encouraging this. We've been talking about this resurgence in Israel, and you definitely see the kind of confidence that Israel has in making this kind of a strike and extending the theater, as you said. If you could tell us about that.
Well, this, I would say that this isn't done just because the United States has Israel's back. Of course they would, but the United States has proven itself over the past 30 years that it doesn't act too hastily in the middle in the Middle East, and I would say against an interest where it's not being threatened itself, like nuclear reactors in Syria didn't act, nuclear reactors in Iraq didn't act, Iranian nuclear facilities didn't act. Israel's the one that's bombed a lot of those throughout history. But it does give Israel confidence that it can act and not fear reprisals, in the sense that that the United States is there watching over it all. But make no mistake, this is not Israel just acting because the United States is there. This is a legitimate threat to Israel. These weapons, these missiles, have a reach of 750 kilometers, and we already know that Iran is pushing them towards western Iraq, and Tel Aviv is only 630 something kilometers away. And so Iran right now has precision guided missile capabilities, so they're going to fire these and they can hit targets. And Israel is extremely worried that they could be fitted, these ones can be fitted, if they had the technology, if Iran did, with a nuclear warhead. They can be. And they can be fitted with biological and chemical weapons. And so Israel is determined to not let Iran get close enough to do that. And if they have to fight, and if they have to, you know, fly over into Iraq and take out these missiles, they'll do that. So this is a legitimate threat that Israel is facing and has to knock out.
All right. We do appreciate that, Brent. We do have an article up on the website by Warren Reich. Israel preemptively strikes Iranian missiles in Iraq. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. And now to what's happening with Germany. The U.S. is seeking its help in patrolling the Strait of Hormuz to protect it from Iranian aggression. And this week, Germany said nein. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, on Tuesday, America made a formal request for Germany, France, and Britain to help patrol the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, we've seen in that area Iran basically kidnap the British flag ship a few weeks ago. So Britain asked Germany and France for help patrolling it. America has been doing the lion's share of the work of protecting and making sure that this strait is at least relatively open, and they'd like other nations to share in some of the burden. You know, they kind of feel, well, all of these other nations around the world are getting the benefits from an open Straits of Hormuz. They're getting the oil, etc., that they need. Wouldn't it be great if they could carry some of the costs? So they turned to Europe. They have made this request, and very quickly Germany turned around and, exactly as you said, said nein. You know, we're not getting involved. But what I think was interesting about this, well, it's interesting that they said no. Bloomberg made a point that this was just kind of a real test of the strength of America's alliances with Europe, whether America has any real allies with Europe right now. And so far we've had nothing from Emmanuel Macron from France. I think he's just not given a definitive answer, a definite no from Germany. I think things are looking more positive from the United Kingdom. So basically you've got the UK being America's only ally in Europe. It shows a lot of where Europe stands with America in general. And then just the way Germany answered this was really interesting, because they didn't say, you know, no, we're not interested in patrolling the Straits of Hormuz, or no, we don't want to deploy our boats overseas, no, we're not going to get involved militarily. It was a very specific no, we don't want to get involved with the US military.
Right.
So they left the door open. They were very specific in the way they opened it. They left the door open for some kind of European-led military initiative, and they said, well, we might do that. But they were very clear they wouldn't do anything that involved the United States.
Yeah, the Europe is definitely interested in keeping the Strait of Hormuz open, and the oil that transits through that passage is really critical to Europe. So for the United States to say, hey, we'd like your help, certainly not an outrageous request by any means, but the clarity of this message coming out of Europe definitely shows just how fractured the NATO alliance has become.
That's right. Just very little willingness to back up the United States. I mean, in fairness to the European powers, behind this is a very different approach to Iran. And so Germany saying, well, we don't want to get involved because we don't want to get involved in a conflict with Iran, and we're afraid that if we kind of line up alongside the United States, we'll end up in that. You know, Europe is more kind of trying to appease Iran. I think they see in backing Iran an advantage to, or they see an opportunity to take down some of President Trump's foreign policy, to kind of cast him as the villain when it comes to pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. They're trying to kind of push this narrative to say everything was great, Iran is our best friend, Mr. Trump was incredibly foolish to pull out of the Iran deal, America was a big vandal on the international scene. So they've been playing that policy for several years. They're continuing with that. But yeah, it certainly does show, even that policy itself, a very significant anti-American bias in the foreign policy.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's interesting as well that a French, you know, flagged vessel wasn't taken, nor a German. I mean, Germany gets most of its oil from Russia, so it's not a huge deal, but France gets most of it from the Middle East. And so, I mean, right now, as Richard's saying, they're still in the nuclear deal. Iran is still trying to work with Germany and France in particular. And so, according to the Europeans, especially those two nations, until one of their vessels gets taken, why should they start policing it? Because Iran probably wouldn't target one of their vessels just yet.
Yeah, it is really fascinating to watch. I guess this is just the oil dynamics of this all play out? Because I know when America did its sanctions against Iran, it was like the Iran state oil company that they give some of their profits to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which is a terrorist organization. And so that's one of the main reasons America sanctioned that oil company. Germany was not thrilled with that particular decision because they are very interested in buying Iranian oil. One of the big reasons they've opposed U.S. sanctions linked to the Iran nuclear deal is because that they're caught in this place with the Nord Stream pipeline. They're currently trying to get oil from Russia. And then President Trump is trying to convince them to buy natural gas, actually. That's what I meant to say, natural gas from Russia. But President Trump's trying to get them natural gas from the United States. And right now, Germany's really been obstinate that we'd rather buy from Russia than you. I guess they hate America that much. But long-term strategy, you can't be a world power when you're completely energy dependent on another superpower. So you need a source other than Russia and the United States. And I do think that seems to be Iran's main angle here is there. That seems to be Germany's main angle here and European Union is that they need that oil in Iran. They may not be thrilled with the mullah's regime, but they don't want to burn bridges too. So they're kind of having to walk a tightrope, keeping that strait open, but not full heartedly throwing their support behind President Trump and sanctioning all those oil companies that they want so bad to do business with.
I think with this, the big angle from the Europeans is them trying to make America and Britain look like the outcasts in their decision here. Yeah. They don't want to join it. As far as they can see, the whole reason there's a problem is because of Mr. Trump's maximum pressure campaign. It's America's fault. So why should we send our warships to try and, you know, make up for what America is doing? And so, yeah, this does just – it highlights the break between America and Europe, but also opens a door for this growing partnership between the UK and the United States.
So, Richard, just looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, how do you view it?
Yeah, I think we have two distinct prophecies here that we're watching. I mean, on one hand, just like Brent talks about, the Bible does talk about a big break between the United States and Germany. It talks about, say, the United States still looking for Europe for help, thinking of Europe as an ally, but you've got a growing enmity between these two powers. So that's one of the big things that's on the that's being put on display here. But then you've also got important prophecies about Germany and Europe getting more involved in the Middle East. So, for example, Daniel chapter 11 talks about the fact that it's not the United States ultimately that deals with Iran, it's Germany, and it's the German-led King of the North, and you can prove that in our free King of the South booklet. Now, I think this, you see both those prophecies in this dual response where Germany's like, well, we're not going to get involved with the American mission, but there's a big debate going on within Germany about getting involved on their own mission. So you've got especially the Christian Democratic Party saying, well, yeah, we're the number one exporting country in the world by some measure. That means we're the number one most dependent nation on open sea lanes. If people are going to keep these kind of straits open, we should be the ones doing it. We should be getting involved in doing it. And so they're talking about still having their own naval mission. And you look in Daniel chapter 11 and that describes this confrontation. It talks about even Germany ultimately coming against Iran with many ships.
Hmm.
And other parts of that verse indicate that that Germany is preparing for this in advance, beforehand. So could we see some kind of limited naval mission as something that prepares the way for the naval part of that Daniel 11 prophecy? So I think we, in Germany's kind of two ways of thinking about this, we see those two key prophetic trends.
Yeah, very interesting. If you want more information about this, go online to thetrumpet.com. We've got an article up there by Daniel DeSanto called Germany Refuses to Work with the U.S. in Hormuz. We'll also put a link to the King of the South in the show notes for this program. Go check it out. And thank you for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We'll head over to Hong Kong now. A troubling development there in the ongoing protests against Chinese authoritarianism. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the protests in Hong Kong are raging on, and there's evidence now that China is amassing more of its forces near the territory, which some analysts say could be a sign that a crackdown is coming soon. So these protests first started back on June 9th, so we're coming up now on the 8-week mark. They've been going for quite a while. They were sparked by a proposed law that would give mainland China an easier way to bring criminal suspects from Hong Kong to the mainland. And that was a terrifying prospect for Hong Kongers because of China's just very deeply corrupt court system. So the protesters were protesting originally against that law. Later, it sort of broadened to be just against China's general encroachment on Hong Kong's autonomy. Back in 1997, when Britain handed Hong Kong over to China, the Chinese promised that for 50 years, Hong Kong could be, it could have a high level of autonomy and sort of steer its own affairs for the most part. But China has not honored that. They've been really turning the screws on Hong Kong, especially in recent years. They've been taking away more and more of the territory's freedoms. So the protesters there are, at this point, they're really just protesting the general erosion of their freedoms. And for the first several weeks, it looked like China would just try to let these protests kind of die out. But now the protests have gone on for so long, and they've even turned violent on several occasions, or at least a few occasions. And so it looks like China could be gearing up to take some action against them, or at least kind of show that it would be willing to take action against them, some sort of forceful action, if Hong Kong doesn't get in line. So at this point, the reports about the amassment on the border there are quite vague. We don't know if these are military forces or if they're just security police forces. But the reports say that either way, China now has some pretty substantial numbers there.
Tell us about this video that the PLA released this week.
Yes, this happened just about the same time that these reports about the amassment of forces came out. But the People's Liberation Army, actually the Hong Kong garrison of the Chinese military, released a video showing their soldiers carrying out a really heavy crackdown on protesters. This video was posted on Weibo, which is sort of like the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, circulated very broadly, and it showed, you know, some actors pretending to be protesters, and then it showed the actual Hong Kong garrison of the PLA. You had troops coming down out of helicopters and opening fire on protesters. Some of them even launched missiles against protesters. They unrolled these barbed wire barricades and blew up cars. So it was a big show of force, a show of just how much the military could do if they wanted to against protesters. So it was really a clear warning to the actual protesters. And this new video just increases fears that the military could soon send forces in to kind of quash what's happening there.
You get the sense that the protesters sense it, but that it's kind of a matter of time in some ways before China takes stronger measures in order to prevent this from spreading because of just what a threat this poses to their authority.
That's right, yes. Time is really on China's side in some ways, just because it would be difficult for Hong Kong to affect any real change. So if they can just wait it out, that would be ideal. They wouldn't have the scrutiny of the world upon them for a crackdown. But if Beijing gets the feeling or sees evidence that it's spreading into the mainland at all, I think we would see a rapid and decisive, you know, quashing of those protests.
Well, we do have an article in our new Trumpet edition. This is the September 2019 Trumpet by Jeremiah Jacques called Hong Kong, The End of Freedom Begins. An excellent article. He talked about it on a recent Trumpet Hour episode, just showing how Britain controlled this territory for quite a long time. And what we're seeing now after Britain withdrew from it, just how quickly it has fallen into Chinese hands and increasing Chinese control, and how that even fulfills prophecy of the Bible. Go and check that article out, Hong Kong, the End of Freedom Begins, and put it in prophetic context. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Now to the American economy. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates this week for the first time since the 2008 recession. Why now, and what will it mean going forward? For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is really interesting. Is on Wednesday, the Federal Reserve, they slashed their target interest rate from about 2.5% to 2.25%, so about a quarter of a percent cut. So not doesn't sound like a huge cut when you say it that way, but like I said, this is the first time since 2008 crisis. You usually do this type of thing, or economists usually do this type of thing, in a recession when they're trying to stimulate spending. But right now, I mean, the stock market's booming, unemployment down, the economy's up. It's mainly concerns about trade war, and that President Trump's talking about more tariffs yet against China, and the fact that this this war with China could make goods more expensive here, and so to try to keep the economic boom going, cut the interest rates, makes it easier for people to borrow money. People will take on more debt, keep buying more stuff. It doesn't matter if goods from China were a little more expensive with the tariff, I guess, if it's just really easy to go put it on a credit card and pay for it later. It's kind of the rationale behind this decision, which prophetically really tells us two things. For one, the trade war aspect is definitely prophetic. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has almost an entire chapter of the Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet, Building Towards a World Catastrophe, that talks about Isaiah 23 and Ezekiel 27 and this mart of nations waging a trade war against the United States. The fact that the Federal Reserve cut interest rates in a time when the economy is seemingly so good is a very telling indication that some very smart people in some very powerful positions are also concerned about trade war intensifying in the near future. And then the second point is that in addition to the trade war, the debt aspect is also significant. It's a little more tangentially related in that that's not necessarily why they're cutting the interest rates. They're cutting the interest rates to keep the economic boom going because of the trade war. But it does make it easier to take on more and more consumer debt. And there's definitely some prophecies in Deuteronomy 28 talking about, like, if you've turned away from God's law, one of the curses is like the stranger will lend to you and you won't lend to him, showing that you won't be a net creditor nation like the United States was before 1982. You'll be the world's biggest debtor nation on both a government level and more and more a consumer level. And that consumer debt has also, I think, recently passed the 2008 levels. So that's two economic indications, consumer debt and cutting interest rates, that harken back to, use the phrase, since 2008, which was America's last major economic downturn.
Mm. Yeah, Richard.
Yeah, I think what's going on here is actually kind of terrifying. You know, you go back a generation or two ago, and the most liberal left-wing economists said, borrow money when we're in recession, when times are bad, because we can always pay that back when times are good. This is, you know, times are good. The unemployment rate is low. The catastrophe of 2008 is well behind us. This is exactly the time that even the most kind of pro-debt economists of the previous generation would be saying, pay back that debt, save. And instead, America's borrowing over $1 trillion each year to fund the budget. And it's exactly the same with interest rates. Again, the standard kind of Keynesian economics policy here is you raise interest rates when times are good, put a bit of a brake on the economy because you can afford it then. That way, when times are bad, you can cut the interest rate, you can lower the interest, you can make it cheaper for people to borrow money, and you can stimulate the economy using debt when it needs it. And again, that was the left position. Now, again, the economy is doing well, but the interest rate is barely above zero. I mean, if you think about what happened in 2008, you had a crisis hit, and America basically got out of it by massive borrowing and by huge cuts to the interest rate. Neither of those are options anymore.
Right.
I mean, you can't cut the interest rate below zero, because at that point, you know, yeah, you can charge negative interest rates. People are just going to keep their money stuffed in their mattress at that point. You know, all of the ammunition is gone when times are good. We've used it all up. There's nothing left for America to do to stave off catastrophe when a recession hits. And recessions happen. The way man's economy is set up, you know, the idea that there'll never be another downturn is just completely absurd. So America's in a really dangerous position between all of this debt and then this rate cut now.
Yeah, this increase in the American economy has been sustained for quite a long time. And as you said, that there's bound to be a downturn at some point. And we were having these conversations some time ago, just how the interest rates being as low as they were prevented us from having anything in the tank to be able to use against it if things turned down again. And here they are, you know, using the very last bullet in the chamber, in a sense, when things are going well. So if people wanted more information about this, Andrew, where would you send them?
Right. We actually had a recent article in our Trumpet print a couple months back now. It's in the May-June edition. I had an article entitled "When Will the Dollar Collapse?" that mentions a bit about the debt, but it's primarily about America's loss of its reserve currency status. There's nations that are losing faith in the dollar because of the debt and are turning to gold, euros, even yuan, even Chinese yuan in some cases. They're that desperate. Just as a financial reserve. And then that article points to a prophetic prediction Mr. Armstrong made decades ago, Herbert W. Armstrong, about that it'll likely be a financial crisis that kind of like levels the geopolitical playing field, where Europe equals or surpasses the United States as a financial power because the conditions here get so bad.
All right. Thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, anger in Germany over a murder perpetrated by a migrant, and Donald Trump hinting at a crackdown against Antifa. These stories and more right after this short break.
Is Trumpet Hour.
Migration continues to be an explosive issue in Europe, and it was brought to the fore by a horrific incident this week in Germany. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, there's actually been a series now of attacks by migrants that have really put this story kind of front and center. So the big one that happened earlier in the week at the Frankfurt's main train station, you had a migrant that was that had come into the country from Eritrea, and he came and shoved a mother and her 8-year-old son off the end of the railway station in front of a train. The mother was able to roll out of the way. The 8-year-old son wasn't. And he died, sadly. But then this led to this massive manhunt to track him down, 6 platforms being closed, a huge police operation, and another big debate about, well, what to do about migrants. And then even just more recently, then another story that's just hit in the last day or so is a migrant coming into the country from Syria. There's video footage of him attacking someone in the street with a katana, with a massive sword. And it just, I think it was another migrant that he was attacking. And again, putting this whole subject front and center in the news. Now, I think come out now that the Eritrean migrant, he was an Orthodox Christian that killed the person, so it doesn't appear that that had a an Islamist motivation. But then you had this Syria, but there's still kind of this random nature of the attack. No, there doesn't appear to be any connection between him and his victims. He just seemed to be some kind of crazy guy who decided he wanted to push people off train stations, and he went off and tried to push someone else and failed to do that. And then you've got this Syrian migrant. And this has just led to all of these different contrasting stories within Germany. You've had from the right and even just a lot of reasonable people coming out and saying, well, what are we doing letting all of these migrants in? These are obviously causing some problems. Do we feel safe? Somebody even grabbed the microphone at Frankfurt's train station after that attack and kind of told said something along the lines of, well, all ordinary Germans, just be aware of where you're standing on the platform. If there's anyone strange around you, move away from them. Stay away from the edges because the foreigners might try and push you off. So it's led to a lot of anxiety. At the same time, you've also had this debate in the media about, well, maybe we should respond by not reporting the nationalities of people that carrying out these attacks. Maybe we should cover it up and try and stop people from even talking about this.
It does seem like we've talked about maybe the larger trend of how this has entered politics. It seems like it's been a while since we had something this visceral that was driving public opinion. But really, this is part of a broad trend that we've seen developing for years. It's affecting politics, not only in Germany, but in countries all over Europe, where you have people who are deeply concerned about the dangerous effects of this flood of migration into the country. And it seems like there's always something to drive it back into the public consciousness like this.
Exactly. And that's important to remember, because I think it can be easy to look at this and think, well, we had the massive influx in migrants. That's in the rearview mirror now. That was several years ago. That peak is over. So the migrant crisis is over. This isn't a thing anymore. It's not a big deal to people. This story is closed. When that's not the case. All of those masses of migrants that came in, they're still there. There's still a certain amount of tension with them. There's still a lot of anxiety within Germany. Can we still absorb? Have we successfully absorbed these migrants? Was this the right thing to do? Are people dying? Are we having upticks in crime because of this? All of those discussions are still going on. This story is still driving things forward. And one of the big ways it's driving things forward is just this distrust between the citizens and the elites. And you see this even in the way that the left wing kind of treats the story of, well, the ordinary people can't be trusted to know the facts. We need to cover this up. And then those kind of headlines just then, it feeds off each other. That makes the ordinary people think, well, we can't trust our leaders. They don't want to tell us the truth. The story is actually even worse than we think it is, because when you look at the way they talk, they want to hide it from us. They're probably doing that already. And so it's fueling a massive dissatisfaction within all of Europe, and especially Germany, with the current leadership, the current ruling class, the current even system of government, the way things are going. And so you see this manifesting itself in things like the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland, now the most popular party in some parts of East Germany, with the dissatisfaction with Angela Merkel and these mainstream leaders, with dissatisfaction of even democracy itself. And so this is one of the big prophecies we pointed to in Europe is the rise of a strongman, a huge political change coming to Europe. And that's exactly what this migrant crisis is really setting the stage for. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, he really focused on this in his article in the January Trumpet print edition right at the start of the year, where he just talked about how, you know, we've been saying for years that there would be a strong leader in Germany, that these prophecies in Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11 that talk about it, but you've never had a situation kind of so fertile for that to happen until now. It's just almost the perfect storm that could bring this about. And that article, it's called Germany, a New King is Imminent. And the migrant crisis is just one of several different strands that you can see really leading to that outcome.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. We'll put links to that article. We also have the article up on the website right now, Migrant Murders Spark Outrage in Germany. You can find that on the front page of thetrumpet.com. So thank you for that, Richard. A different brand of terrorism in the United States. A couple of recent incidents highlight the dangers of the Antifa movement, and President Trump says it's time to do something about this. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Last Saturday, President Trump announced, as is his custom via Twitter, that he's considering officially labeling the Antifa movement a domestic terrorist organization. This is actually kind of a follow-up public announcement to a bill that was already introduced to the Senate a little earlier, asking that Antifa be officially declared a public terrorist organization. And surprisingly, I guess a lot of people probably don't know the history of that movement, so it's surprising to me at least, is there's getting a bit of pushback from that, where you've got this Ich bin Antifa trending on Twitter. I don't know if that's how good my German was, but that is supposedly German for I am Antifa. That's trending in both the United States and Germany. Antifa was originally a German movement, as I'll get to in a moment. I do need to backtrack a little bit to cover why the Senate's doing this now, as there was an Antifa terrorist back on July 13th who lit a car on fire and pointed a gun at police officers and tried to throw Molotov cocktails at a immigration center in Washington, which kind of put the public spotlight on how dangerous this movement's becoming. And the man who did this, he wrote a manifesto talking about how he was trying to liberate a concentration camp or at least this twisted worldview. This was a concentration camp where, overlooking the stark difference that this is a detention center for people trying to escape their countries and come to this one,
right?
Where in the actual Nazi Germany, it was the other way around.
Subtle difference.
All right. So you've got a subtle difference there, but this is what's really prompted the president and the Senate to look into labeling this a terrorist organization. This man's manifesto is harkening back to, as I mentioned before, like the original Antifa movement, which was it was the paramilitary arm of the Communist Party of Germany in the 1920s and 30s, gained fame for fighting the Nazis. And I mean, that's why they get the Ich bin Antifa now, is they're like, well, we're fighting Nazis, we're liberating concentration camps, we're doing all these great and bold and righteous things. But their goal was to establish a communist dictatorship in Germany. And their worldview is a twisted worldview. I mean, he cites Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, which is a different history from the United States as you can get from Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong's The United States and Britain in Prophecy. The United States and Britain Prophecy is all about these huge blessings that God just poured out on the United States and Britain. And then this People's History of the United States is taking this, focusing in on some of the bad history that has happened in America, but focusing on it to an extent that you're making it look like America's the new Nazi Germany, and we need an Antifa movement to tear it down, and that is their goal, is to destroy the United States. That's why the president wants to label them a terrorist organization, and why it's so concerning that they're getting some public support from even those who until fairly recently were kind of moderate, who just don't like Donald Trump.
Yeah. Yeah, so this fella at this this ICE agency, this facility in Tacoma, he throws fire bombs, sets a car on fire, points a rifle at the police. The police shoot him. The Antifa or the Black Lives Matter activists in that area say he's a martyr for the cause, that he was doing this something righteous that needs to be done. These people that are they're advocating violence against the system at every level. They're going around with baseball bats and beating people who are not doing anything violent. It is a very dangerous movement that has caused quite a few incidents like this. Donald Trump justified in calling it a terrorist group. If he does do this, what are the effects of this? How much is this intensifying the conflict within the United States?
It will be very interesting to see to what extent this particular movement becomes significant in that way. Originally, in 1930s Germany, they actually played an important part at getting Hitler's rise to power, because they the conflict between them and the Nazis, they were both attacking the democratic center, and it led to the rise of the fringes. There's still very few actual fascists in the United States, and their numbers have not been going up, but the numbers of left-wing radicals have been going up, because surprisingly, this is decent publicity for them. I mean, firebombing a ICE center is not something you'd think that a bunch of people would publicly support, although there have been more than you'd think. But right now, being on Donald Trump's bad side seems to be get you some brownie points amongst the Democratic Party. So a lot of the criticism coming from CNN and some of these other major news sources are kind of glossing over what this Antifa radical did, and then more focusing on why Donald Trump shouldn't label them a terrorist organization.
Yeah.
And so that does slowly but surely getting more and more of a shift from what used to be the center left to the radical left, and even those willing to use violence to try to start a civil war, some especially amongst Antifa. There are actually a number of them who are more open about the fact that that's what they want.
Yeah. Well, Andrew has an article up on thetrumpet.com called Antifa Wants to Destroy the United States, and it points to these prophecies that describe a civil war unfolding within the United States, really serious prophecies that we see at least progressing toward their fulfillment in America today. Thanks for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. If Antifa thinks it's hard being a protester against the government in the U.S., they should take a look at what's happening in Russia. That's exactly what we'll do now by going back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, if you watch the news in the U.S. this week about Russia, you might think that Vladimir Putin is on some pretty thin ice. There were pretty significant sized protests in Moscow and in other parts of Russia. These were anti-government protests staged by people who were angry that certain candidates had been blocked out of a local election. It was a Moscow City Council election. And in Moscow, almost 1,400 protesters were arrested. And one of Russia's most famous opposition figures, a man named Alexei Navalny, who had urged people to come out to these protests, he was jailed before they began. But then during the protests, he began to show symptoms that looked a bit like poisoning. So it's hard to say what exactly happened there, but there's a lot of intrigue here, and it was the most arrests made at a Russian protest in more than a decade. So a pretty heavy-handed response there from the government. And we're hearing a lot about how these demonstrations could signal some serious trouble for Vladimir Putin, who has now been the leader of Russia for almost 20 years. But what the Western press really hasn't covered is that even as these protests are happening, Putin's popularity is still sky high. It has fallen since its peak in 2015 when he had 89% approval rating. But the Levada Center has published new data showing that it's climbing once again right now, and it's back to about 68%. So still remarkably high. And Levada published the results of a new poll on Tuesday showing that a majority of Russians, 54%, would even like to see Putin carry on as president after his fourth term ends in 2024, even though the Russian constitution prohibits that. So the protests we've seen are significant. You know, they show that, yes, the people of Russia have some frustrations. They're unhappy with the United Russia political party. They're unhappy with the general decline in living standards that they've been suffering. But they're still giving Putin personally a pass on all of that. And for the most part, they still stand behind him, even enough to be willing to amend their constitution to let him keep on ruling for, you know, who knows how long.
What is it that the protesters are really upset about?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, this particular protest was in part because some specific candidates had been blocked out of that local Moscow City Council election. But there's also just a general struggling economy. There have been increased taxes on the populace. Salaries are declining. There was a deeply unpopular pension reform that happened, I guess that's about a year ago now. So Putin really is under pressure. And even in this decision to jail Alexei Navalny, you see that he is feeling the heat right now. Back when Putin's approval rating was up in the stratosphere at 89%, he kind of seemed to enjoy giving his biggest critics free rein. He kind of liked to let Navalny and other critics walk the streets freely and say whatever they wanted to, because in a way, Putin could use that as a signal to Russia and to the world of his, you know, his munificence and his serenity, his all the power that he has. I'm not afraid of these critics. I'll let them walk the streets. So the fact that he jailed Navalny is not a sign of strength, but really of weakness. And it does show that Putin's feeling the heat a bit right now.
And it seems like those times in the past where he's maybe his public approval has dipped, that he's taken some pretty strong measures to try to shore up his popularity, and at times to other nations' detriment.
Yes. Yeah. And it's very possible that the pressure Putin is under right now could prompt him to orchestrate a repetition of what we've seen in the past there. As you said, in the past, when his approval rating was at its highest, that's been largely as a result of his invasion of the Republic of Georgia and then of Ukraine. So if the pressure continues to mount, we could see him try to rally the country behind him once again with another expansionistic action of some kind.
Well, we do have Gerald Flory's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, that explains why we really believe that Vladimir Putin is going to remain in power despite the pressure that he's facing. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today, and we appreciate that, Jeremiah. One final story now, archaeological news, another discovery from the period of King David that matches the historical account in the Bible. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, these discoveries are very rapid fire these days, it seems. One coming last month with the discovery of biblical Ziklag. And just this week, it was reported that on the Philistine, inside the Philistine territories, one of their major cities of Gath, a layer that belongs to King David's time and King Saul's time and also Goliath's time was finally discovered at the site. And so this is important, obviously, beside the point about just David. I mean, just the timing of this is stunning. They've been excavating Gath for decades, and they have been mostly excavating a city there that was built around King Rehoboam's time, so David's grandson, and then stayed in existence and use for about 100 years until it was destroyed. But the city from David's time, the city that we attach all the stories of Gath to, was elusive. We didn't find a layer from that period, or the archaeologists didn't find a layer from that period. But this season, after the archaeologists decided to open up a new area kind of away from the main part that they were excavating over the previous decades. They wanted to see what was underneath this terrace, or like a large terrace wall structure. They removed the terrace from this later city, and they find massive stones, massive walls, and all of it dates from that very specific period of Goliath and David's time. This is a quote from Aaron Mayer now. He is the archaeologist there. He said this: "I've been digging here for 23 years, and this place still manages to surprise me. All along, we had this older giant city that was hiding just 1 meter under the city we were digging." And so this is absolutely stunning. I mean, if you talk about Gath from the Bible, this is the city that Goliath was from, as I said. This is the city that the Ark of the Covenant went to after the Philistines confiscated that in the battle with Eli, or during the time of Eli. This is the city as well that David entered and feigned himself as a madman, and he's, you know, scratched upon the gate. That was here. This is also the city that David fled to with 600 of his men on the run from Saul to take refuge with King Achish. And so all of those stories, now we have the city that the physical city where those biblical events took place.
Very exciting, and your enthusiasm is infectious, Brent. Brent has an article up on thetrumpet.com. Goliath's city is more than myth. He also did a Watch Jerusalem podcast on this, Gath Davidic Era City Finally Revealed. Go check that out at watchjerusalem.co.il and find out more about it. Really interesting stuff. We appreciate that, Brent. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with these words of Frank Lloyd Wright: "A professional is one who does his best work when he feels the least like working." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.